It's your girl E, and this is The Call, where we talk to wildly inspiring women about their journey to answer their life's calling. So we took a week off last week for the holiday, and I hope everyone got a chance to eat some good food and be around family and friends, and maybe acknowledge the true history of this land that we're still occupying, you know. And in between all of that, I hope you got a chance to catch up on some of your favorite episodes of The Call. Now, speaking of faves, this week's episode is definitely one of mine. I cannot wait for you to hear it. But first, to quote Queen Cardi, I don't dance now. I make money moves. I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. I couldn't help it, y'all. Okay, a quick word about our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Juice Beauty. Here on The Call, we talk a lot about inner beauty and the health of our souls, our careers, our lives, and the world. Well, Juice Beauty's founder, Karen Behnke, believes that we shouldn't have to sacrifice any of those to look really good on the outside, too. They offer high-performance skincare and vibrant makeup made with antioxidant-rich certified organic ingredients. And a big part of their mission is sourcing from USA organic farms so that every organic drop feeds your skin. You should check them out for your skincare and makeup needs by going to juicebeauty.com/thecall and signing up for emails to enjoy a special offer with your first order. So go do that After listening to this really great episode. All right, let me just cut to the chase. This week's guest is one of my dream interviews. I've listened to her show for years, and it really has opened my mind. It's made me cry. It's made me wiser. No, I'm not talking about Oprah. I'm talking about Peabody Award-winning journalist, entrepreneur, New York Times bestselling author, and the host of one of my favorite podcasts and radio shows, On Being, none other than the Krista Tippett. If you're not familiar with Krista, let me see if I can explain her work. In 2013, she was awarded a National Humanities Medal by President Obama. And as he hung the medal around her neck, this is how her work was described.
The 2013 National Humanities Medal to Krista Tippett, for thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of human existence. On the air and in print, Ms. Tippett avoids easy answers, embracing complexity and inviting people of every background to join her conversation about faith, ethics, and moral wisdom.
In other words, Krista has really deep and important conversations about faith and everything that relates to it, from religion to science to politics, just the human experience overall. From the moment I first heard her years ago, I felt super connected to her, which is not a feeling I'm used to having with white women over the age of 50 who grew up in Oklahoma. But from her childhood in church, to her early career in politics, to her exploration of life's big questions now, I've just always found her voice to be so helpful in figuring out how to craft a life of meaning in these crazy times, which is something I think we're all trying to do. Now listen, let me say this. I know that not all of you are faithy like me, or religious, or even spiritual. Shout out to my atheist listeners and to the big chunk of you that just have a bunch of questions. That's actually why I love Krista so much. No matter what your background, Krista has a lot to teach all of us about how to be okay not having all the answers and how to still develop a rich inner life. In a moment when religion is being used as a sword to divide us, I think it's a gift that we can all appreciate. Now, she's definitely got that NPR public radio voice thing. So you're going to love listening to her. Sit back and enjoy collecting some wisdom from the author of Becoming Wise, Krista Tippett, here on The Call. Well, Krista, thank you, thank you, thank you so much for doing The Call.
I'm honored to be with you.
I'm really excited to have you. I wanted to get you on the show for two reasons. One was selfish and one I think is, you know, generous for my audience. the selfish one, which I guess is the perk of hosting a show, and you know that, is that I get to talk to people that I admire, and you kind of always been or long been a mentor in my head. There's some parallels in our backgrounds, and you've really been a model for what I see as the next phase of my own career. So selfishly, I'm excited to talk to you and kind of pick your brain. But for the sake of the show and the sake of my listeners and our community here at The Call, I'm always looking for voices who can talk about faith and spirituality and religion in an accessible way.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do it inspirationally, right? And I'm a preacher's kid, so I grew up around a lot of really inspirational speakers who talk about faith and spirituality, but not everyone is accessible. Mm-hmm. And you are.
Yeah, and I've been working for a long time you know, how to talk about this in a way that it can be a broader discussion that we can have kind of in the middle of our life together without excluding people,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to say that has to come from, I would guess, a lifetime not just of doing this work professionally, but really of living this stuff, of wrestling mm-hmm. in your own life with faith and spirituality. I know you always start your shows with the question, what is your faith story, or some variation of that question? And therefore, I know you've been asked that question a million times. So I'm going to try to put a spin on it and start okay. with the present and then have that pull us backwards. So why don't we start with, if you were going to title the current chapter of your faith story, what would you call it?
Oh, no. This is hard. The current chapter of my faith story. I would say more about questions than answers.
Mm.
But really in love with the questions, right? That's not less vital than when the answers were clearer to me.
Right, right. It's not less vital, but it is, it feels like a long way away from probably where you started, right?
Yeah, well, where I started, I was a preacher's grandkid, and where I started was all about the right answers and the rules to live by and the terrible punishment that would come your way if you didn't follow those rules.
Mm-hmm.
It was clear cut. And, you know, there's a certain comfort in that.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't big enough for how the world is and how complicated I am and we all are.
When did you realize that you were different, that you had changed? I think these changes, these evolutions happen over time, over a lifetime of formative experiences, and we'll talk about some of those. But was there a moment when you kind of looked up and said, wow, I am no longer the girl mm-hmm. from Oklahoma, the Southern Baptist granddaughter, or I no longer look at the world or faith in the same way that I did then?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, too. I mean, I went far, far away to college and, you know, very flukishly. I went to Brown, which was in Rhode Island, which is like really you couldn't get farther on the map from the small town in Oklahoma that I went to and stay in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that happened as soon as I went away, and I'd really not much been outside kind of Oklahoma and Texas when I was growing up. And so the thing about church growing up for me is that it wasn't just a place to go on Sundays and Wednesday nights. It was social life, right?
Yeah,
it was
mine too.
It was really the culture, right?
Yeah.
It was the whole, and there was a lot of beauty about that. But when I went away, that container of culture and friends and social life was gone. And so the religious practices and the theology also, you know, absent that, just made less sense.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, there was a moment, I don't know, I think maybe I studied history at Brown, and there was a moment where I learned there in a class for the first time what makes the Southern Baptist Church the Southern Baptist Church, and it is that Southern Baptists broke away because they wanted to keep their slaves.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I had never learned that history growing up. It was just shocking to me. And not only that, not only had I not learned that history, I had learned that only Southern Baptists are going to heaven. So
right,
like Methodists
right.
don't have a chance. American Baptists don't have
Man,
a chance.
That's hard.
Right. And so this was just really just so deeply unsettling for me. And, you know, my grandfather had a second grade education. He also, I think, had a big mind that he'd never been invited to apply. I went home, and he was my grandfather. I mean, he was an authority figure. I didn't exactly challenge him, but
mm-hmm.
I asked him,
mm-hmm.
Gaggy, tell me, what makes a Southern Baptist Southern Baptist? And I honestly don't think he had been taught this history either, or he was ashamed, or he had suppressed it. But anyway, he got this puzzled look on his face, and then he said, well, Jesus was born in the south of Galilee.
Wow. That's the best
you know,
answer I've heard.
Yeah. And that was a made up answer. And that was this moment for me of kind of I'm done, you know.
Okay.
And again, I don't recall that I told him he wasn't right or called him a liar. It was just internally I kind of, you know, I put a wall between myself and church. But, you know, eventually, like 10 years later, I came back mm-hmm. to claiming a spiritual life and being really interested in theology and studying theology. And at that point, I was really interested in the disconnect and also the overlap between spiritual life and religious tradition and religious institutions.
And that's one of the things that's present in all of your work that I personally am drawn to, because you talked in the beginning about questions, and I want to a little bit later find out how you got comfortable living with those questions, right? Living in the questions, as Rilke said. But even before you got to that point, you had recognized there's some things that are challenging me about what I was taught, about kind of the dogma. And yet you still talk about that time in your life as beautiful. You talk about embracing traditions. You say that the language of religion and Christianity is your mother tongue, and it's mine too.
Yeah.
How did you kind of reconcile those two things on your journey without completely, I don't know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, if you will?
Yeah, well, in the beginning, I did throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, I would say for a good 10 years after that moment I just described, I was just completely disinterested. I wouldn't say that I ever became, you know, kind of a militant atheist. It's not so much that I took a stand against it. I just didn't think it was very interesting or very relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting on with my life, and I was doing political things. I was being a journalist. And it was when I started coming back in my late 20s to human questions. You know, I'd been really interested in questions of, I don't know, saving the world, the nuclear arms race, you know, high-level politics.
Uh-huh.
And I started to get interested in how people create lives of dignity and meaning connected to but not dependent on what their political situation is.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to ask, you know, that this is a whole other part of life that, in fact, politics doesn't address. And when I started asking that kind of question,
mm-hmm.
it led me back to be thinking about theology and religious tradition. And, you know, the questions and the passions that this discipline, really, you know, like this thing, this religious enterprise in our midst in all its diversity, that this is the place or a major place where we ask those kinds of questions, where we explore those aspects of ourselves.
So that said, do you believe that all of the questions have answers, right? There's the unknown versus the unknowable. And I ask that specifically because, again, another similarity in our backgrounds is that, you know, growing up in church, loving church life, church culture, but entering into a career in politics and being, you know, pretty clearly liberal and radical and very focused on changing the world and wanting to see how I could reconcile these two things. And the biggest challenge that I had was it felt like in the political world, and I was in the advocacy space, but also a little bit in commentary and communications, there was no space for questions. Everyone was turning for answers, right? You're supposed to be the expert. And that's, you know, that kind of challenges, I think, people like you, maybe people like me who say, but there's so many bigger things here to discuss. But when you get to the point of discussing them, are there answers?
I remember early on, really more in the pilot stages of my show, interviewing Robert Coles, who is this great psychologist at Harvard, and he wrote the book, The Spiritual Life of Children. And he'd also wrote about the moral lives of children, the political lives of children. And he talked about how all of us, and parents know this, that because you know, you actually see it in your children, but it's true of all of us, that we ask these delving questions. We start asking these big questions that we ask the real questions at the beginning of life, and then they kind of get drummed out of us, or we think we're not supposed to, you know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
why do people die, and why are people mean to each other, and, you know, where did we come from? And you know, Robert Cole said that one reason that religion is this delving part of life, that its origins are in that kind of delving, that is just so essentially, elementally human. And just that is such a different way to think about religion than the religiosity that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you're right. It's also a very different approach to life than the approach to issues that we have in what we call news and journalism and media and communications. It's mostly not searching. It's posturing and it's arguing and it's entertaining, and there's value in all of that, but there's more that we need to be doing if we're grappling with what is really important. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even if what's important in the world, right? Not just in terms of like, you know, heaven or God. We need to be searching and grappling with these huge questions to make meaning of our lives.
Right. And what kind of world we want to live in.
Yes. And what kind of world we want to help make.
Yes. Now, all of these questions resonate with me, and I hear people asking them now and thinking about them, and this is what your show is all about. But I'm so curious about the moment when you recognized, you know, asking these big existential questions can be a career, right? Because I certainly didn't grow up believing that outside of church, right, you can be a preacher, you know, or you can be an academic. But other than that, there's no other space where you can make a living doing this, asking these big questions. So when did you have that kind of light bulb moment? Or was it a light bulb moment?
Yeah, I don't know if it was ever that clearly formulated. I had been in Divided Berlin. I had this, you know, I had this kind of turn away from thinking that all the answers or even all the interesting answers were political and that all the interesting questions were political.
Now, pause there. You said you'd been in Divided Berlin. So just so folks know, that was a political journalist. Yeah.
And then in the 80s, in the, you know, whole another world ago. And I went to divinity school to not... I wanted to dive deep into this kind of thinking, partly to test it, right? I knew that I was having this experience of this reality of a certain way of questioning of, you know, of the meaning that these traditions have for us, even now, even with all their flaws. But I kind of went to divinity school because I couldn't actually believe that I was having these thoughts, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wasn't going to go back to the same kind of religious way of being that I'd grown up with. So I didn't even really know what I was headed for. And I didn't go to divinity school thinking I would be ordained. It was in my mind that possibly that would be something that I would get drawn to. But I knew pretty much like 10 minutes after I got there that I wasn't one of those people who was going to be ordained. That's not what I was there for. So... honestly, it didn't make a lot of sense that I was at divinity school.
I was just going to ask. So and, not to be ordained, how do you get there?
Yeah. I mean, there was this thing called lay ministry, but it was definitely kind of the second class option. I mean, most people were becoming ordained or they were going into some kind of religious scholarship. And then there were people who were on a spiritual search. I didn't quite fit into that category either, but I didn't know. Honestly, I didn't know. I couldn't tell people what I was going to do with this degree. And when I came out, you know, I had a Master's of Divinity, which is such a presumptuous title for a degree. I actually started doing things that were more, that used my skills of the work I'd done previously, you know, journalistic, analytical writing. But at the same time, as a person, as a citizen, just as a consumer of media, I was just so dismayed. I mean, this was the mid-90s, and this was the age of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. It was kind of the media preachers and Christian Coalition and Moral Majority. And it was kind of this new, very polarizing voice of religion, which I always hasten to add was absolutely a convergence of those voices and journalists who were fascinated and riveted and kind of handed over the microphone and cameras to these people.
And oh, so, interesting. I think that's important to note, the role of media and journalists in kind of the rise of at least the platform of the religious right.
Yeah. I mean, they amplified those voices. And the thing is, one thing that happened, I mean, and... you know, there's a long history to this. I mean, in fact, Christians, evangelical Christians in particular, for most of the 20th century had kind of withdrawn from public life. And there were theological reasons for that. You know, they had said, that's not where we're called to be. We're saving souls. We're working with people as they move through their lives. And they saw dangers in being involved in politics and public life. But those voices that then re-entered with a lot of political agendas, squeeze themselves into political boxes and political modes of discourse in order to be heard. And they were really effective at that. Mm-hmm. For journalists, it was very useful for these voices to enter the fray in such a recognizable form and be talking about issues rather than preaching, right? Mm-hmm. So it was really a collusion, and it was so toxic, and it was polarizing in all kinds of ways. What I watched in the 90s were people who, you know, there's such a spectrum of how religious people are politically, right? I mean, very progressive to very conservative and lots of gray, you know, in between, and people who don't fit into a box where if you say you're progressive, this means you check all the boxes on this side. Or if you say you're conservative, you check all the boxes on this side. What I watched is religious people really anywhere closer to the center or to the left or even like the center right, even though I hate those categories, they just got really quiet. And so we all kind of handed over the voice of religion in the public sphere to a very extreme kind of voice that actually wasn't representing most people, most Christians, even most evangelical Christians. So I'm watching this, and I had just, you know, tested whether theology could be relevant. I had been steeped in really discovering for the first time the depths of tradition and ritual and sacred text in ways I'd never been taught growing up. And honestly, part of my motivation for starting the show was I was shocked that I never learned most of this in church. I was in church 3 times a week my entire childhood.
Yep.
And I had never really been theologically educated or invited to ask theological questions, which are fascinating and riveting and exciting. And yet I'd had to go into all this debt and give up my life for 3 years to go do this thing. And I really felt like this discipline in our midst should be available. It should be something we know how to talk about, like we know how to talk about art, or we know how to talk about politics, or we know how to talk about economics. So all those things kind of came together in my thought, well, maybe public radio is a place you could do that. Back then, podcasting, God had not yet invented podcasting. So, you had to go through these official channels. But then it was a long, long road of making this case and showing it could work and showing that it wouldn't just make people really mad and have them turn off their radios.
The part of that journey that I connected with a lot, and I think so many of my listeners will, although in different ways, is not feeling as if what you see on television or in mainstream media or that has been kind of taught to you as representative of your community is actually representative, right? So whether that's as a person of faith, or myself as a person of color, there was this moment, especially when those of us who are millennials were growing up, where we saw all of these images on television and the consolidation of media was happening and the explosion of cable networks. And we're seeing all these images and hearing these voices, and they're not particularly reflective of not just what we believe, but also, like you said, the questions that we have.
Yeah. You mean, and even ideas about millennials.
Absolutely.
Even that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, it's true. I mean, what I just said about religion, you could say of everything, the way we do public discourse and, where the microphones and cameras go is not representative of most of us, and it's very limiting. It simplifies what in fact is complicated in the way we live it.
Yeah, and I wrestle with what to do about that. Right. So obviously we create media. One of the things for the past has it been 8 years now? I was almost fresh out of school when I started, but there's an organization called Auburn Seminary that I'm a part of.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Okay. So you're
I am, yeah.
That makes
so
sense.
So I do on the side. Mm-hmm. I've been done media and messaging training for progressive leaders of faith for the past 8 years.
Oh, yeah. That's so great that you're involved in that.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And it was kind of for me the aha moment, the awakening of, wow, there are so many people out here, who are fighting for justice and who are asking these deep questions, and I never hear them and I never see them. As much as I can help them, I want to. But this is where I'm going to get to my question. What I've been doing and what many people who are involved in this process do is, okay, well, let's create the big, big, big platforms to get their voices out. Let's try to teach them how to talk in the sound bites that everybody else talks in.
Yeah. Right.
Let's try to teach them how to tweet so that they can kind of play in the same battlefield that everyone else is playing in. And I wonder, as someone who has spent, you know, a bulk of your career focusing on wisdom, on slowing down and asking the questions, on, you know, chewing and wrestling with these big ideas, is it possible to do that in a soundbite culture, on social media, in cable news? Is that like a futile endeavor?
I wouldn't say it's futile, but I think it's perilous. I think it needs a lot of intentionality and probably kind of, you know, lots of discernment. That's a good religious word, right? Like that's like there are words that are like discernment is something we need so much in our political life and public life in general. So,
how do you define discernment for folks who don't typically use that term?
You know, the difference between getting informed and being discerning, right? I mean, it's this next step of reflection on what we have learned or what we see, what to do about it, what to do with it. We take in so much information, but, you know, being discerning is making a choice about what we're going to let our... one thing I'm talking about a lot now is, what are we going to orient towards? This is a huge, really spiritual, political challenge right now, I think, especially for progressive liberal people. Yes, we need to be informed. You know, yes, there are things we need to know. But there's a difference between attending to that, but also orienting yourself towards it, which in a way is becoming captive towards it and becoming part of the dysfunctional dynamic. So discernment to me is that point where you say, you know, I see this, I know this, and this is what I'm going to do with it. This is what I'm going to take. This is what I'm going to not let inside me. This is who I'm going to be.
Being able to see, observe, be another spiritual phrase, kind of being in the world but not of it,
like yeah,
being aware of what's happening and alert, and in some cases as necessary responsive to it, but not necessarily internalizing it and being consumed by it.
Yeah, and responsive perhaps, but not reactive. And sometimes it's hard to, you know, that line is fine.
What's the difference? How would you describe the difference in terms of, let's kind of shift into talking about our current political climate. How can one be responsive to what's happening but not entirely reactive?
I think a lot of us, and I think this is true on every side of the political spectrum, all the way through 2016 and since the election, are just reacting. We're just reflexive. To me, that is about the fear place in us. And the fact that so many of us, and I do see this on every side of the political spectrum, are living with these, you know, on this ground of fear. And there's pain out there, too. There's pain and fear. And one thing we know about our brains and our bodies is that when that's the place that we have sunk into and that we're responding out of, it's our lizard brain, you know? It's not our reflective selves. We, in fact, are then no longer in charge. And it's very hard for us to rise to our best selves if we're moving out of that place, if we're letting ourselves react out of that place. Part of the problem, I think, is that we actually don't have a vocabulary for talking about pain and fear. We do outrage, right? And we reward outrage. Right. We reward anger. We know how to be powerful with our anger and powerful with our outrage. I really think if we're going to get at the root of what divides us, what plagues us, how we have to change, how we can possibly get to know our neighbors again, we're going to have to find ways to talk about the root, which is our pain and our fear. And our longing and our questions, right, are just the open questions that are so painful. But if we talk about those things, then we wouldn't fight about these answers that, in fact, are very tenuous, you know?
I agree theoretically. Let me, and I might also agree practically, but I want to play devil's advocate for a second there, because when I hear you say we need to kind of get to a place, or I agree with fine language, to talk more about our pain and our fear, I think the next word that comes to mind for me is vulnerability, right?
Yeah.
You have to be vulnerable in order to do that.
Yeah.
And then in this climate, when I think about vulnerability, I think about the communities that are most vulnerable. right? I think about, people who, you know, the threats aren't just existential in this moment, right? They're material.
Yeah.
And so what does it look like for people who are already vulnerable in whatever context, people of color, women, Muslim Americans, LGBT folks, what does it look like for them to have to then become more vulnerable? And is that realistic? Is that the goal?
No, you're absolutely right. Especially in our public spaces, the way they're set up now, it is not reasonable to ask most of us to be vulnerable or even let our pain and fear show. So here's where I bring in another great religious word, calling.
The name of the show. The show is The Call, based on that exact idea.
I think there are many callings in this moment. And what I want to say is you're absolutely right that one of the aspects of this moment is that there are people who are in danger, right? Who are on the front lines of being in danger. And though I am not saying that they are called to put themselves out there to be vulnerable, but I think those of us who are safe, and, you know, some of us are called to throw our bodies in front of those bodies and the danger. Mm-hmm. And some of us, I think, are called to be calmers of fear, to be bridge people, creating spaces. And I don't think these are, you know, these might be media spaces. They might be the media space I have. They might be the media space you have. But I think it's also just like local spaces, like in our neighborhood, in our community, close to home, where it's with trustworthy, quiet spaces where it is actually reasonable to invite people to let their fear down and to let their guard down. Mm-hmm. I think this is a long-term project, right? Like, this is what we're doing between now and the next election. This is a whole cultural shift.
Yeah.
But I just think it's necessary for us to create the reality that we want to inhabit. And we're so far from it now. There's so much work to do. But it's, you know, when you say it that way, I mean, I really am full of hope because I do see, and I know you see this too, there are so many people who are being generative and creative and loving. They just don't get the attention, right? They do not get those microphones and cameras put in front of them.
Nope. The attention, the support. Yeah, absolutely. So then in thinking about how we want to create this world, which is, again, a long-term project, how does spiritual life help us do two things? Do that, right? Create the beautiful things that we want to see in the world. And also, you know, the other side of that coin is, how does spiritual life help us stop the other things? You know, I think we hear a lot about, spirituality and faith and religion as you said, a calming tool is the wrong word. That sounds too manipulative. But right, as a way to help calm and allay fears.
Yeah.
We hear about it as a way to bring peace. I rarely hear, although in some spaces I do, but I rarely hear it talked about as a way to stop the hate, right? Not just help us cope with it. But how does it do that?
Yeah. And well, you don't hear about that, but you and I know that most religious people in most religious communities, and that's a blanket statement, but the thing about the religious people who are leading nourishing lives of love and care and service, there's a humility that goes with that. They don't have PR, right? They are busy doing the work. They are feeding hungry people and repairing lives and communities and caring. And that's what they're doing. So
would you say they're fighting too, though? Would you say they're...
Some of them are fighting, yeah.
I was going to ask if you would use that term. Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I was pulling out from what you said, too, is that, you know, again, everyone has a different calling. And so that spirituality helps us, you know, feed and clothe and nourish and nurture. But it can also help us fight.
Absolutely. It always drives me crazy, the incomplete picture that we get. I mean, even with some of these things on the surface of our life together right now with refugees and immigrants and Islamophobia, for example, or racial justice, to the extent that there are communities out there grappling with this stuff, And creating, you know, sanctuary, and sometimes literally defining themselves over against laws. Many, many of those activities are happening, you know, in religious institutions, in churches, but we just don't hear about them. We hear mm-hmm. about the ones who take a stance against the other. You know, I think the word spiritual, like the word religious, it works for some people and it doesn't work for others. And I really do honor mm-hmm. the fact that these words are fraught and they're loaded with a lot of connotations. And it's interesting because, you know, for some people, the word faith is so meaningful. And for some people, the word spirituality is so meaningful. Right. And for others, the word spirituality is flaky. And the word faith just carries all the burden of, well, sometimes really, really damaging things that have been done in the name of religion. So set those words to one side, but I, you know, to me, spiritual life is a way to start talking about inner life, interior life. Mm-hmm. I personally think that an atheist has a spiritual life, although I know atheists who don't like that language, and I know atheists who are quite comfortable with it, right? And so to me, saying that you have a spiritual life does not imply you have a belief in God. But it does mean that you have this place of searching where you are asking the questions of meaning. And these questions are not taken up in our political and economic spheres. There are as many ways of doing this as there are lives. So there's a really individual mm-hmm. piece to it. And but I think one of the great things that religion brings into the world at its best is also the communal doing of that, and the fact that we accompany each other, that you're not alone in being discerning, and then kind mm-hmm. of walking through the world, being true to being a healing presence, a loving presence, to being of service. Something that got lost in American life and in Western life in the last, you know, somewhere between the middle of the 20th century and now, which is just, I feel like right now our political life is kind of a caricature of this, and our economic life is a caricature mm-hmm. of this, that We made inner life optional, right? Like, we reward people who make a lot of money.
That's a great way to say it.
And who are successful in a material way. And we reward celebrity. And we have a president now who actually embodies the things that we have celebrated.
I think he's a reflection of our inner life, not, you know, as individually, but right as a society where we are.
Yeah, and it may have the expression of it and is different on the, you know, progressive side of the spectrum, but, you know, through and through culturally, these are the things that we value. These are the things that we privilege, that we reward. This is how we measure a good life, and it's not good enough. And so to me, the frontier we're on now, and I see millennials absolutely on this frontier, right? Like, I'm so hopeful because of millennials, mm-hmm. because of the millennials in my life.
Good.
I know. It's ridiculous. So it's reclaiming that. And this is not turning away from having an outer life or a public life, but saying, you know, insisting on something called integrity, insisting if we talk about integrity, authenticity, transparency, you know, these words that millennials have kind of imposed on our general vocabulary, you know, this is about being the same person inside that you are outside. And to me, there's an intelligence in this too. And I don't know how much of this is conscious or how much it's just kind of growth that comes. You know, something that I think went wrong with the great revolutions and movements of the 20th century is that they got spiritually exhausted. You know, the civil rights leaders will talk to you about this, and the 60s radicals will talk to you about this. And there's a bizarre straight line you can draw between make love, not war, and hedge funds, right? So we know this, but we haven't paused to reflect on it. But I kind of think millennials like get this, because in fact, they were born into a very cynical world that actually resulted mm-hmm. from a very idealistic world. And what got lost is this inner grounding, this attention to nourishing in an ongoing way, and to accompanying each other in keeping that vital. And that inner life, mm-hmm. you know, I think there's this there's this constant back and forth. I don't think anybody I know, well, some people choose to live on one side or the other. But I think people who are nurturing both, you know, inner life and outer presence in the world, you walk back and forth across that line all the time. But understanding that they're connected and that keeping them connected is a way, in fact, not just to have a life of integrity, but to have a life that is sustainable and human.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you know, and not how does one know, but you, Krista, how do you know, or maybe even feel, how do you feel, or when do you feel, as if you're doing enough? And this is really a question about measuring your impact, right? We've talked about kind of these big questions of life and of society and the way we want to create the world that we live in. And yet day to day, right, you have a job, you have an enterprise, and you've found a way to merge those two endeavors together. But how do you go to sleep at night and feel, you know what, with all that I'm trying to accomplish and frankly all that the world needs, I've done what I can do and I'm happy with where I am and what I'm doing and my contribution to the world?
Oh, you know, I'm not sure I've ever gone to bed feeling that way. I learned something back, so I don't, but this actually does get back to the inner life question, but I'd never quite connected it this way. This is the mark of a great interview.
Great.
Yeah, I was very fortunate in those years in the 80s when I left my big impressive career behind to think about theology and spirituality. I read a lot of the mystics. And one thing that I got that has never left me and that has been just absolutely essential to this question you're asking is that what we have control over and what our calling to have control over is our intention. But that even at the moments of our greatest success, but also at the moments of our greatest failure, we do not control the results of our actions, right? And we in a sense, right, we have to do what we feel is right and good and noble. And we always have to let go of the results in some way. And there's a beautiful side to that, mm-hmm, because I think, you know, we will never know all the ripple effect good things that come of what we do in the right spirit. But also it means that we cannot be judging ourselves by metrics, you know, by the metrics that, mm-hmm, are out there. It's not that those things don't have a place. They have a place. They have a place if you have a nonprofit. They have a place if you have a media project. But in terms of my personal, I don't want to say satisfaction because I'm never very satisfied, but my personal sense of, you know, worth and if it is justifiable that I did what I did today, I have to know I did it for the right reasons and in, mm-hmm, the right spirit. And I did my best. And then I have to let go as much as I can. That gets a lot easier as you get older, I want to say. Right.
So I was going to say, I work really hard at that, and I'm not there yet, but I know that's
no,
the goal.
This is something, I mean, this is a muscle that gets flexed over time. And it's mm-hmm, also, this is one of the great things about getting older. There are a lot of great things about getting older, is that you have the experience over and over again, over time, also with these unexpected ripple effects that, you know, you might not find out about until years later. So you kind of start to trust that, but you, mm-hmm, trust it through experience. But I'm happy to say it to you, you know, because I read it when I was in my 20s and I couldn't internalize it yet, but I was able to hang on to it so that every once in a while I got it, you know, every once in a while, on my worst days, I would say, okay, I don't think this is going to work. I've blown it, or the world is against me, but I know it was the right thing for me to do, and I'm going to carry it all the way through. And that has turned out to be a good way to live.
What has surprised you on the journey from, you know, when you're letting go and you're saying, I've got my intention, I've got my questions, mm-hmm, I've got my calling, I've got my discernment, all these things. What has surprised you about the result of that approach to life?
Well, in many ways, this has been so much more successful, like by the regular metrics than I kind of, you know, than I could have planned or expected. And also I've stuck with it such a long time, which isn't really the way I was. It really, you know, became a calling. Mm-hmm. But even so, you know, success is just like when, especially when you start working with those regular metrics, it's just never satisfying for very long. I mean, I can always compare my media project to so many, you know, bigger, more successful, quote unquote, media projects, right? So it's never, that is just such a dead end to be measuring yourself that way. It really is. And mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I don't think this is what you meant when you asked, but this is actually where I am right now in this moment. I just took the summer off as a sabbatical because I had over, you know, 15 years here, I have worked myself into this incredible state of exhaustion, which is partly because mm-hmm. I was also raising kids and starting a project and all that. You know, I'm trying to not be too hard on myself about this, to say, you know, there are times in life when there's just too much to do and you just mm-hmm. keep living through it. But it was so amazing for me to get quiet, to really disconnect.
Did you go somewhere?
July was almost completely ended up being totally in solitude on the north coast of Scotland. And in August, I was in Australia, which was a great adventure. But I think what has surprised me, and this is something I've also been learning these years, but really just like taking me to another level with it, is getting back in my body and how much for me well-being and even spiritual well-being is connected to my body. And it's not thoughts and it's not just prayers and it's not just, you know, some kind of heady inspiration. It's how you feel. Like, I got rested. I stopped hurrying. And I'm now kind of reordering my life, my working life here, to keep this feeling of being grounded and of flourishing and well-being. And it's kind of surprising to me. And we are so out of touch with our bodies because we push them so hard, right? We're mm-hmm. so unhealthy. You know, we think sleep is for the weak and... Mm-hmm, there's so mm-hmm. many ways that we don't take care of ourselves. I mean, what we've done with food in the last 50 years, and we're kind of, you know, we're turning away from that. But our bodies are great teachers. You know, like, I think I was so tired that I haven't been able to listen to it. But to get to this place where I can listen to it, you know, this thing about intentionality and your presence in the world, like, our bodies are always helping us gauge that if we mm-hmm. are letting them be our teachers. I don't know if this sounds weird, but this is a great revelation to me right now.
No, it's not weird at all. And it's actually, I mean, it's very timely. I think a lot of people are having the conversation now, especially folks who are, you know, not just pursuing their own professional goals, but really, really throwing themselves into, you know, social change and social impact work. And the conversation around self-care,
yes.
right? And
yes.
Audre Lorde's self-care being a revolutionary act,
yes.
and a political act. I think that conversation I'm seeing is coming back around and rising to the surface. So no, it doesn't sound weird at all. Mm-hmm. So before we close, because I could honestly talk to you for another couple of hours, but I won't. We've talked about calling. You've mentioned it a couple times. Because, you know, your work focuses so much on words. I think it's Elizabeth Alexander that calls them words that shimmer.
Yeah.
And you talk about that a lot. You reference poetry. How would you describe or define a calling? It's a word we've used so much throughout the interview, and I have my own way of thinking about it, and that's the premise of the show. But what's yours?
Calling is also the language of vocation, you know, is vocare, to call. It's called, mm-hmm. called forth. To me, this is very important language for now. One terrible thing that the 20th century did, and this goes along with our reverence for making money and, you know, having a big job, is we narrowly equated vocation with job title. Mm-hmm. Or with career. And that is just so impoverishing. It becomes even more impoverishing in a world in which that just doesn't mean what it used to mean. And people are crafting their lives. And I honestly think it's unsettling, it's terrifying, and there's a lot of danger and vulnerability that goes with this. But for us to, there's something good emerging that people stop defining their value by, you know, their job title or the work they do. Because yeah. vocation is so much bigger. Your calling is as a human being. And so your vocation, your calling is about the wholeness of who you are. I also think it shifts across the course of a lifetime. So even when I was raising my kids, even though my job was important, you know, there are times where my primary vocation was as a mother, you know, and there are times mm-hmm. when your primary vocation is in your intimate relationships or as a child caring for a parent. Your vocation is, you know, who you are as a friend, as a neighbor, as a parent, as a child, as a person with a professional life, as a person with avocations, you know, the things you do that you don't get paid for. For many people, I think mm-hmm. that's where the meaningful work is. I'm doing some writing right now. I was just thinking about this. I read a poem by William Stafford, who's a poet of the 20th century, I've just discovered. So there was this line in this poem, which I thought, this is the definition of vocation. In fact, I wrote it down in my notebook. I'm going to grab it right here. It's the last line of this poem, and he said, it's a poem in which he says, talks about his father, what his father taught him. Your job is to find what the world is trying to be.
Ooh.
And I love that for
what
right,
the world is
what the
trying
world
to be.
Is trying to be. You know, there are loftier definitions of vocation. Like there's this definition that that used to get thrown around a lot from Frederick Buechner, that your calling, your vocation is where your deep gladness meets the world's great deep need, which is so mm-hmm. beautiful. But again, I feel like that's too much, you know, that makes everybody feel
so
like a failure
pressure.
Who hasn't,
it is.
Right? It's terrible.
And especially, I think, for our generation, for millennials and even younger, there's this narrative right now. We've kind of fetishized, you know, entrepreneur culture,
yes.
being
yes.
your own boss.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, everything has to have purpose and everything is your passion.
Yes.
And so there's
it's exhausting.
It's overwhelming.
And you have to make it up yourself. You know, people didn't used to have to create their jobs and create their identities and create their institutions. That's not natural. Like it's hard. It's too hard. I love this humble, beautiful, you know, what the world is trying to be. I mean, to me, I think one reason I love that is because there's so much on the surface of our life together that looks like the world is trying to be terrible, you know, mm-hmm, mean mm-hmm. and tribal. But we all know that just below the surface of that, there is human pain and devastation. And I see so much more evidence, which, as we've been discussing this whole time, doesn't get all the attention and publicity, but the world trying to be more and better and to rise to its, you know, its better capacities and not really being sure how.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the calling for each of us, you know, my generation, and this is part of what got us to this bad place, this bad grandiose place was, you know, save the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or create the world's biggest company. So that's
right.
That's not right. And it actually was harmful to other human, our fellow humans. This calling that is more reality-based is where you live, like the world you can see and touch, you know, your mm-hmm. family, your neighborhood, your community, your job, your workplace. What is the world trying to be? And how are you, how is your presence? Just, you know, our calling is also, it's not, maybe you're in a crappy job, which a lot of people are, like your job isn't meaningful on the surface, but it's how you are. As much as what you do. And we have a power, you know, to be impacting the people around us, the world around us in so many subtle ways, you know, all day long that we don't celebrate in ourselves. And to me, all of that gets at what calling means in general and like right now in this confusing world.
I love that. I love that. Okay, so you're going to get a couple calls right now.
Oh!
and you tell me. I love that, because that's, first of all, you speak in poems,
yeah.
which is, like, it's just so beautiful. It's so beautiful. And so I'm going to shift and make calling very literal. I'm going to pretend that three people are calling you, and you tell me what you would say to them.
Oh,
if they
boy.
Called.
Okay.
Okay, so the first is your dream interview. Who is it, and what would you say?
So here's the thing. This is a little bit sideways, but I used to have this list of, you know, people I wanted to interview, like Desmond Tutu, right? People like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And these days, what I find so exciting is to discover people who are just below the radar. And these people are everywhere in every world and every discipline and every community. You know, there are people who are inspirational and wise, whose presence is just changing all kinds of lives, but they're not famous above that radar. So what I love now is discovering these people who are actually writing this generative narrative of our time. And so I don't know who they are now, and I don't know what they're doing, but, you know, the starting question, if it started this way, would just be, you know, tell me where you are and tell me the story of our time that you see and that you're making.
That might be the best answer to your dream interview question. I don't know who they are, but tell me. Yeah. I love that. I love that. Right. Okay, the second call, the current president. I don't like to say his name.
Yeah. I was just in Australia and somebody asked me, you know, what would you say if you interviewed Donald Trump? And I said, I don't think Donald Trump is a very good listener. And I don't think that, you know, he wouldn't be listening very well to a question either. And honestly, I generally don't interview sitting politicians because they're not rewarded for, like, thinking out loud and, right? I don't know what the question would be, but what I would try to do is find some question that would surprise him enough that he might, but it would probably be, you know what? I might ask him about the spiritual background of his childhood. Because that is a very disarming question. Because like it's disarming, it's surprising. Because if you asked anybody, including me, probably including you, if you ask anybody, like, what is your, tell me about your spiritual life, right? That is just a terrifying question. And I think most of us would be tongue-tied. But if you ask people about the spiritual background of their childhood, for some reason, you know, it's like they don't feel like they're divulging about themselves. They're talking about this child. But it ends up being a place that's very revealing, where we had a lot of questions and we had a lot of unanswered questions. And there's a lot of yearning there. And I would actually be – and then, you know, sometimes people, you know, if they didn't have a traditional religiosity, but honestly, people usually work with it, like that they expand the definition of spirituality. So I think it would be very interesting to see what would happen if he got offered a question like that, that really, hopefully he would not feel like it's going to come back to bite him, you know, that he had to spin it or that he could spin it.
I would actually love to be a fly on the wall for that
one.
And last but not least, this person calls you. What do you say? Your 25-year-old self.
No. I have thought about this one a lot this summer. I've thought about how I was telling somebody about my early, like, life trajectory, and they said, how did you become so brave? And I completely brushed off the question. And then I started wondering why am I not more tender towards my 25-year-old self? That's a very present question to me because I've said, I really love millennials and I have a lot of conversations with millennials now. And I think it's a brave thing just to be alive right now. It's brave to be building your life right now. And I would want myself to just take that in. And also what I would tell my 25-year-old self is, as serious and intense and determined as I was, you know, to let myself take pleasure and to know delight, like where it's possible to just be delighted, seize that. I didn't know that when I was 25.
A lot of 25-year-olds don't. I didn't when I was 25 either, especially the brave part.
Yeah.
That's a great reflection. That's a great reflection in hindsight that I hope my listeners hear and take to heart, no matter where they are, no matter what age. you know, that being alive right now and trying to build a life and at the same time build a world,
yeah,
it's hard. And you know, doing it with some grace and compassion for each of ourselves on this journey, doing it with some thought towards our inner life and trying to if not find our calling, then answer some calling. And as you say, be what the world wants to be or is trying to be. And thank you for helping us all on that journey, Krista. Thank you so much.
Erica, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, yes, yes. Don't you just feel wiser? I do. I always do when I listen to Krista. Thank you so much to Krista Tippett for that thoughtful conversation. This episode was published by Man Repeller, of course, and produced by Melody Rowell. I'm your sister, your girlfriend, your hostess with the mostest, Erica Williams-Simon. And until next week, you know what to do. Keep loving, keep fighting, keep dreaming, and of course, keep answering your call. Peace, y'all.